You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, author Rax King says there's no reason to feel guilty about our guilty pleasures. She tells us why in her book, Tacky, Love Letters to the Worst Culture We Have to Offer. Find out more today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a pair of recent studies looking at white-tailed deer in Iowa and Ohio found the SARS-CoV-2 virus, that's the one that causes COVID-19 in people, in more than 30% of the deer population in each of those states. There's no evidence that deer can spread the virus to humans. There hasn't been a similar study in Wisconsin, but the state health department recommends that Wisconsin hunters take a couple extra precautions during this current gun deer hunting season. This isn't the only virus that can move between humans and other animals, and our next guest is on the lookout for germs that jump species. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about animals and the coronavirus? What concerns do you have? Are you a hunter or someone in your family or network? Have you been following this news? What do you think of the guidance, such as wearing a mask while field dressing a deer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tony Goldberg is the John D. MacArthur Chair and Professor in the UW-Madison Department of Pathobiological Sciences in the School of Veterinary Medicine. Tony, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be here.
Well, we've got these studies out, not peer-reviewed, but the authors thought this could be a big deal. We're going to get it out there. What is your reaction to what you're seeing in these studies of deer?
Well, I think it's pretty scary. I mean, when SARS coronavirus 2 first emerged in people, we quickly discovered that it was most likely a bat virus that had gotten into people. So a lot of people, including myself, started to look at bats, thinking, gee, what if it went from people into bats in North America? But at the beginning, nobody thought deer. So it was pretty surprising, although some early research on the susceptibility of different animals did predict that deer might be a problem. So we should have listened more.
It seems like the scary part, as of right now, it doesn't seem like there are cases of deer to human transmission, but the idea of yet another animal, I guess, reservoir of this virus. What do we worry about there?
Well, that's right. The fear here is that white-tailed deer could be a reservoir. And by a reservoir, we mean an animal species that has enough virus in it to serve as a source of infection for us. One that most of us are familiar with is West Nile virus. It lives in birds and mosquitoes, and there's enough infected birds and mosquitoes out there that every once in a while it gets transmitted to people and makes us sick. Once you have that situation where there's another species with the virus, it becomes a whole different ballgame with respect to getting rid of it, because you know it's tough enough convincing people to get vaccinated, but try telling deer to get vaccinated. They certainly won't listen.
I know we have cases of virus transmission from non-human animals to humans. It's what causes a lot of our most famous diseases. It seems like the one that causes COVID-19 in humans, it can go to a bunch of different animals. I've seen cases of it being picked up in zoo animals, mink populations. It seems to spread quickly and be very hazardous there. Now, deer seem to carry it. No illness, I guess, associated with it. Is this unusual versatility for a virus?
This is unusual versatility for a virus, but not for a coronavirus. So different viral families, like the coronaviruses or the flaviviruses where West Nile belongs, or the filoviruses where Ebola virus belongs, they have different host ranges. And it's been known for a while that the coronaviruses can have a broad host range. We saw this with SARS Classic, as my friends like to say, back in 2003, when there were civets and other animals implicated in the transmission of the virus from bats to humans, and MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, and the virus that causes that is known to infect camels. So these viruses are pretty tricky in that regard.
I know one virus that we humans have managed to eradicate is smallpox, but my understanding there, Tony, is it didn't have this other animal reservoir. With a virus that can live on in so many different species, does that make the idea of eradication impossible?
Well, that kind of depends on whether or not deer turn out to be a reservoir. As the CDC and everyone is saying, there's no evidence now that deer can transmit the virus to people. But there's no evidence that they can't. All we have is lack of evidence. So if we, you know, hypothetically imagine that deer could transmit the virus to people, that is a bit of a game changer, because if we got rid of it in people, it could just come back to us from deer or from some other species. So that's a concern. The other concern is that what went into deer from people might not be the same as what could come out of deer. Viruses have this pesky propensity to evolve. So we would expect that a virus that got into deer might undergo changes and mutations and evolution and could spin off new variants that, you know, in a worst case scenario could be more harmful or even could escape immunity that we might have naturally or from vaccines. That's all speculation, but these are the sort of nightmare scenarios that are spinning around in people's heads right now.
Talking to Tony Goldberg, professor of epidemiology in the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Looking at news, a couple studies in Iowa and Ohio found the virus that causes COVID-19 in us people, found it pretty common in deer. Talking about that and more general questions about viruses that bounce from species to species, you can join in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tony, I've talked to you over the years about how we try to watch for viruses and other species that might be likely candidates to cross over to humans. What is our radar like? How do we start to try to suss out among the many, many viruses out there, what likely culprits are?
That is the $64,000, or I'm dating myself, $64 million question. The ability to predict which of the millions upon millions of viruses in nature might be the next one to jump and cause a pandemic is the focus of a great deal of research right now, as you might imagine. There are new programs that the NIH and the National Science Foundation looking specifically at that. The best predictor we have right now is, are they related to something that's jumped over in the past? So SARS coronavirus 2 is related to SARS virus, which jumped over into people from bats. Influenza viruses jump over frequently from animals into people, so we can expect them to as well. Flaviviruses like West Nile virus jump from animals to people on a regular basis. So that's our best bet. But going beyond that, there's all I can say is there's an enormous amount of research in every field from molecular biology to computer science trying to get at this very question.
Do we have consistent support funding-wise for this kind of research? Because I've heard tell, at least during that SARS outbreak that you mentioned, people were really interested in funding research on coronaviruses in animal species. SARS went away, and maybe some of that interest did too. Do we have kind of peaks and valleys in when it comes to supporting this kind of research and analysis?
Unfortunately, we do. I kind of have a feeling we're going to have a sustained peak right now because of what's going on in the world. But as you know from what you do for a living, things have news cycles. So it's difficult to perpetuate the public or the politicians' attention on certain issues. But I think we may be at a turning point with COVID-19 in that I don't think there's anybody on the planet who doubts the usefulness of being able to predict future pandemics and maybe stop them. So my hope is that we are seeing the beginning of a new era in pandemic research.
With this pandemic, there's been interest from the start in the animal origins of this particular virus. You mentioned bats. People have pointed toward pangolins. What are you watching for in the ongoing effort to figure out where this came from?
I'm watching for someone to find a population most likely of bats that has a lot of a virus that is very similar to SARS coronavirus 2, if not identical, and yet they're healthy, because that would be evidence of a reservoir. So I'm in the bat camp for sure. We know of many viruses in bats that are very similar to SARS coronavirus 2, and I imagine some cave somewhere in the world where these bats are just living peacefully with this virus and and not getting sick. And it was just unlucky that something happened and they were able to transmit it to a person who started the pandemic.
We're talking to Tony Goldberg, professor of epidemiology in the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, talking about viruses that jump from one species to another. The species include humans, of course. After some recent research on SARS-CoV, the novel coronavirus that causes COVID-19 in particular, being found in deer in neighboring Iowa and also over in Ohio, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more research on this, on deer in Wisconsin, say, in particular, since that hasn't been studied yet, as far as I know? Do you have questions for our guest about viruses that jump from other species to us humans and how that all works, how we try to detect that, maybe prevent it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're a hunter about to go out hunting, are you going to follow the guidelines to wear a mask? Not while you're out hunting itself, but while you are dressing the deer you are hoping to get. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about deer and other animals carrying the coronavirus that causes COVID-19 in us humans. Tony Goldberg is with us, professor of epidemiology in the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jim joins us now in Hartford. Jim, hi.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jim?
I want to say, Tony, what are you, nuts? What did we just go through? Where millions of people died all over the globe. There, you have positive words for coronavirus going away. It's morphing. It's changing. It's never going to go away. There's a lot of experts who say it's going to be a human companion for the rest of our lives and beyond. No, stop playing with viruses that may protect us in the future. Will they leak? And there's other accidents. How far are we ahead now?
Oh, I think I see where you're going, Jim. Tony, Jim, I think worried about if we're researching the virus, we risk exposing ourselves to whatever the next virus might be.
Well, there is that concern. And thanks, Jim, for the call. I would say that I agree with you. Most scientists think that we're not going to get rid of SARS coronavirus 2, the virus that causes COVID-19, very quickly or at all. And in fact, there are about 20 to 30 human respiratory viruses that have evolved to become sort of mild, like the common cold virus. But almost all of those, if not every single one of them, began as a virus of animals. So it's just a fact of how we live as people and a fact of life on this globe that we interact with animals. So there's a certain level of risk that is just a baseline for contracting new viruses from animals. And they often evolve into human pathogens over time, but that's a long process. So I agree with your sentiment. And I would say that in terms of going out and studying them, we finally are at a point in human history where we have the tools and the knowledge to get out ahead of these things. So I think now the benefits of finding the next one before it hits outweigh any risks that we may pose by going out into nature and looking.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. We got an email from Mary who says, critters like rodents, fox, raccoons, and coyotes can feed on deer carcasses and frequent the same areas as deer. Are these animals at risk of infection from eating deer, or would it only spread through the air between animals? So other mammals in the neighborhood of deer, do we have a worry there, Tony?
Great question. This is one of the things very much on the minds of epidemiologists and wildlife biologists. We are fearful that this may not be just a deer thing. We already know, for example, that mink can get SARS coronavirus 2 and can transmit it and get sick from it. And there's plenty of mink in the woods where there's deer, and they would very happily eat a deer carcass. What we don't know is whether consumption of infected deer meat can cause infection in the animal that eats it. We think that the mode of transmission of this virus and the overwhelming majority of cases is respiratory and through aerosol, so sneezing, coughing, stuff like that. But, you know, I wouldn't eat certain types of meat from a deer that I knew was infected with COVID just out of an abundance of caution. So, I think that we're going to see experiments and field studies looking at this question exactly. But, it's plausible to imagine that other animals in the woods of Wisconsin or elsewhere might contract the virus.
Talking to Tony Goldberg, professor of epidemiology at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, looking at viruses that cross from one species to another with new research finding the virus that causes COVID-19 in humans, finding it in deer populations in Iowa and Ohio, not studied yet here in Wisconsin. Still time for your calls with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. We heard from Tom in northern Wisconsin who couldn't stay on the line. Tom wants to know how the virus could have been passed to deer in the first place. I don't think we have a solid answer on that, Tony. What kind of things would we be looking for, though?
That's a great question. And these are all great questions because they're all the big questions people are asking. One thing I got to say is that the paper that inspired this recent cycle of news about transmission to deer showed that it didn't just happen once. It actually happened multiple times in deer in Iowa. So it wasn't just a single isolated event. So we have to think of something that people frequently do. It's rare, as I'm sure you agree, that to be like standing in the supermarket checkout line with a deer. Mm-hmm. So it's not something like that. It's open to question, but my guess is that it's probably something that's transmitted through the environment in rare cases. So if I were to sneeze or cough or spit in the woods, and you know, a couple of minutes later, a deer comes by and sniffs it, that could do it. People have talked about water. Maybe there's contaminated water and deer might drink it. So we're really not sure, but there's plenty of examples in nature of human viruses that move to animals, including respiratory viruses. And even though we never really know exactly how it happens, it does seem to happen.
Let's go back to our callers now. Todd is with us in Madison. Todd, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to ask about, Todd?
My question is, as a deer hunter, I haven't gotten one yet, but are there any precautions you would recommend after you harvest the deer for processing it in the field, gutting it, perhaps skinning it, and preparing it for butchery?
Todd, that's a great question. And Tony, I pulled this up from the Department of Health Services there. They suggest, in addition to the usual hygiene you'd want, wearing a mask while doing that field dressing, limit cutting into and handling the deer's lungs, throat, and mouth nasal cavity, so respiratory system, limiting that to only what is necessary. And if you're immunocompromised, consider asking for assistance with carcass processing and handling. Tony, what do you think of that advice? Maybe an abundance of caution, but what do you think?
Yeah, I have the same website right up on my screen in front of me, Rob, because I anticipated this question. That's a good question. First of all, hope you get a deer. Second of all, what's going on right now is that DHS is recommending measures that are general hygiene measures out of an abundance of caution. So if I were out field dressing a deer, I would wear a mask because, you know, I'm a risk-averse epidemiologist. the other thing is, you know, just I think generally being aware of germs. It's not just SARS coronavirus 2. There's bacteria, there's other viruses. You know, we all know about chronic wasting disease, and we have to be careful about that. So I think just keeping a mindset that you want to minimize direct contact with tissues and bodily fluids, as we say, of deer, that you want to wash your hands thoroughly when you're done, that you want to cook your meat thoroughly, and that you want to avoid certain organs or parts of a deer are all good things, even without SARS coronavirus 2 in the picture.
Todd, great question. Thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. John is with us in Oconomowoc. John, hi.
Hi. I am calling. I'm a dairy farmer, and we have vaccinated dairy cattle for rotocorona for about 30 years or more. And I'm curious if that offers coverage for COVID-19 or if COVID-19 is too specific or the vaccine not specific enough. Furthermore, I'm curious if the deer are actually getting COVID-19 or just rotavirus in general.
John, thanks for the call. Tony.
Good, great questions, John. First of all, as for your second question, the deer are not getting sick or at least not getting very sick. Even in experimental infections of deer, they just kind of get maybe mild respiratory signs. And we're certainly not hearing reports of deer running around the woods, coughing and sneezing and wheezing. So they're not getting sick. As to your question about the cattle coronaviruses, that's a really interesting one because people may not realize that there are many coronaviruses of domestic animals that we already know about. You mentioned the bovine variant. There's a feline one in cats. There's canine ones, porcine ones, and pigs. The bad news is, in answer to your question, no. A coronavirus like the cattle one would be different enough from SARS coronavirus 2 that it almost certainly would not offer cross protection, as we say. The good news is that cows are a species that doesn't look from their genetics like they're going to be very susceptible to the virus. Now, you never know because it's not just genetics, but they didn't come up as super high risk in the initial analyses like deer did. So we can hope that SARS coronavirus 2 is going to leave Wisconsin's dairy industry alone.
Tony, that's all the time we have. Thanks for joining us. That's Tony Goldberg, professor of epidemiology at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, talking about coronavirus in different species. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, gas prices up, especially compared to a year ago, not the highest in recent memory. We'll find out what's driving those prices, that and more tomorrow on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, some legal experts warned against drawing larger political conclusions based on the verdict of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. But that didn't stop a lot of people from doing so. Coming up, we look at what advocates are saying about the acquittal and what it means for the Second Amendment, self-defense laws, racial justice, and other issues. First, with vaccines widely available, airline travel is expected to be up 80% compared to this time last year. With a surge in holiday travel, some airlines have brought back routes they canceled during the pandemic and added new ones. And in spite of a vaccine mandate for federal workers, the TSA has said it doesn't expect major delays. We're talking now about travel in the second holiday season of the pandemic, which will look pretty different compared to last year. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you traveling this holiday season after holding off on travel last year? Are you worried about COVID safety? Do you feel good about traveling at this point in the pandemic? In particular, I'd love to hear from you if you are flying soon or if you have been on an airline trip lately. What was it like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Megan Hart is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She recently wrote about the TSA and holiday travel. Megan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've been keeping up with the TSA about compliance with the federal vaccine mandate and whether or not it's going to cause any delays at airports. What are they saying?
Sure. So I actually checked in with the TSA today. The vaccine mandate went into effect yesterday, and they say 98% of Customs and Border Protection agents are compliant with the mandate, as are 93% of TSA workers. So they are not expecting any delays.
And flights, I understand, are going to be up 50% compared to last year during this Thanksgiving week. Still, I think, lower than pre-pandemic, though. Can you tell us what the predictions are for what people are going to be doing when it comes to flying this next few days?
So I've recently checked in with a few different airports in Wisconsin, and it kind of varies depending on the airport. In Milwaukee, Thanksgiving flights are up 50% compared to last year, but down 7% compared to 2019. And they've got a bunch of new routes available this holiday season that were not available last year. But then if you look at other airports, Green Bay is pretty much back to normal. especially with the return of international travelers recently. International travelers who are vaccinated have been able to come to the U.S., and that's been a boost for Wisconsin airports. But then other airports like Madison haven't seen quite as dramatic of a rebound. They say traffic is still down about 40% compared to pre-pandemic time. And part of the reason for that is that's primarily a business airport, and they say that business travelers have been slower to return to flying.
When you talk to airport officials, are they giving any indication for travelers on, you know, show up earlier than maybe you used to in normal days?
Yeah, so I've got a lot of advice from the TSA and from airport officials. There's a lot they want people to know. In Madison, they did suggest arriving 90 minutes early for flights. In Milwaukee, 2 hours before flights. And Milwaukee also suggested booking and paying for parking in advance to ensure that you've got a spot if you plan to leave your car at the airport. And then they also wanted everyone to know that the mask mandate is still in effect on airplanes, so you need to have a mask. And then we've seen recently some airlines struggle with staffing shortages. So airport officials suggest that you download the app for the airline you're flying so you can stay up to date on any impacts that we may see during the holiday season. One other thing that we may not think about often, especially for people who didn't travel last year, is they said don't wrap your holiday gifts. So TSA agents do not enjoy unwrapping holiday presents. So pack them, unwrap, and wrap them when you arrive. And then finally, they just asked everyone to travel with their patience this holiday season, especially, some airports in Wisconsin primarily travel to destinations where people will maybe, larger airports where people may be connecting. And so airport officials say those larger airports might, you know, have some issues with staffing shortages at concession stands and things like that. So they suggested trying to be as patient as possible and packing some snacks.
Don't wrap the presents. Do pack the patience. I get it. Megan, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Sure, my pleasure.
Megan Hart is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She talked to us about the TSA's expectations for holiday travel this year. We're going to continue our conversation about travel during this holiday season, second one of the pandemic. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have big travel plans? Do you have air travel plans? Or are you holding off, taking a wait-and-see approach? Or do you have a question for our next couple of guests, couple of travel experts? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Deborah Dunn is the travel editor for Off Duty at the Wall Street Journal. Debbie, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And Barbara Peterson is a freelance writer covering air travel and a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal. Barbara, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
Well, Barbara, let's start with you. We just heard what Wisconsin airports are expecting to see nationwide. What are you watching for when it comes to the number of people hitting the skies?
Well, this Thanksgiving season looks like it will almost be back to 2019 levels. That's obviously good news for the airlines. It, though, is not necessarily such great news for the travelers, because one thing that is different this time is that the number of flights, the actual number of departures that the U.S. airlines are operating, is still way down from 2019. So that's why when you get to an airport and you get on a plane, it seems awfully crowded. In fact, most flights are taking off literally 100% full. There are no middle seats at all free. And that went by the wayside anyway. So anyway, yes, it is going to be very busy, but the airlines and the TSA say they're prepared. So we'll see.
Well, Deborah, that makes me think if I had dreams of getting a great airfare bargain, the math that Barbara just laid out there says maybe not so much.
Yeah, well, you really have to game it a little bit. And luckily, there are lots of websites to help you with that. So one that I really like is Scott's Cheap Flights. You can, set your favorite airport or your favorite 10 airports and see what kind of great last minute airfares are out there.
Now, how about a safety, Barbara? You mentioned those full flights going on. What do we know about what kind of precautions, what kind of things we should weigh before we buy that ticket or before we get on that plane?
Yes. Well, for air travel, I think most people should know that it is really very safe. considering, you know, that you're traveling with a lot of people in a very small space. And the reason is that the airlines, and they did this before the pandemic, have very good filtration systems, and the air gets circulated from the ceiling to floor, not from front to back, which some people mistakenly think. And it, of course, you know, makes you worry about it. Is this someone coughing 10 rows up? Are you going to get that? No, the airlines, and actually it's a federal requirement that all air passengers and crew wear masks. And, you know, there have been a number of notorious incidents this year about, you know, people refusing to do so. And when they do, there are serious consequences. So it is really enforced. You should wear a mask and maybe pay a little more attention to what kind of mask. You know, if you are concerned, get an N95 mask. Those are considered to be the most protection, or wear a double mask. Be aware of your surroundings. If you're at the airport, you don't have to join the scrum at the gate, you know, like at the same time everybody else does. And in fact, maybe while you're waiting for your departure, if there's another gate that seems kind of empty because there's no flight there, just move for a while to a less crowded space. So I do think that there are pretty much, you know, they're common sense sort of precautions, but that should ease a lot of people's fears. And I would also remind listeners too that, you know, if it was a serious risk, if air travel really was, you know, the super spreader event, we'd be hearing a lot more about people getting very sick after flights. And we have not gotten that data this year. So the evidence suggests that you know, it is actually quite safe.
Debbie, that's protecting our health. How about our wealth? If people are worried about buying an airline ticket because A, what if I get sick, or B, what if there's a big outbreak at my destination and I want to cancel because of that? What's the refund situation like these days?
Well, I think, when you're shopping around for your flight, I think you need to be really careful about not booking a flight that you can't cancel. So the airlines have kind of stepped back, you know, initially none of the flights were, weren't stuck with anything, but now they've reintroduced sort of tiers. So I do think it's still pretty careful. You have to be pretty careful about not getting the cheapest ticket if you're at all concerned. Now is really the time to consider travel insurance. Especially if it's kind of if it's a pretty expensive trip and, you're at all concerned that things could change. I think it's really time to dig into the fine print of all those insurance policies.
We're talking to travel.
And I could just add one thing.
Barbara,
there is a type of travel insurance, as Debbie mentioned. Yeah, this is a great idea, but there's one that is called cancel for any reason. And I think that if you really want to be, totally, sort of comfortable with it, you could get that. It's more expensive, but a lot of airlines will not give you a refund, for getting sick. That's just not something they've heard. So that cancel for any reason is just an additional precaution if you're really concerned.
We're talking to travel writers Deborah Dunn and Barbara Peterson. You can see their work in the Wall Street Journal. We are looking at air travel this holiday season and beyond, the second holiday season of the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests about traveling in the next few days, in the next few months, or maybe planning ahead for an air travel destination in the future? Do you have suggestions of your own for making travel easier? Have you been on a plane in the last, few months? What did you think of the experience? How were things flowing at the airport? Were things civil in the skies? Do you want to know how to prepare for your upcoming trip? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on how to travel safely this holiday season and beyond with Wall Street Journal travel experts Deborah Dunn and Barbara Peterson, and with you, if you'd like, at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about air travel in the next few days, the next few months for our guests? maybe a recent experience? Do you have a ticket in your hand waiting to, or on your phone, waiting to travel soon? Do you have questions about the airport and airplane experience? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Tim is with us in Madison. Tim, hello.
On your phone?
Hi. Yeah, I have a question. I bought a ticket a while back for my wife and my stepdaughter to come over, but then they locked the country down, so we had to cancel. They gave us a voucher, and now that America opened up 2 weeks ago or whatever it is, they're saying that we have only a few weeks. It's like second week in December, I guess.
And where are they coming from, Tim?
Players. Pardon?
And where are they coming from? What country?
They're coming from England.
England. Okay. Tim, thanks for that call. I don't know if either of you want to take a stab at that one. They've got a voucher for a canceled trip. The clock is ticking, and it sounds like they can't actually travel in that time. Do they have any options?
Well, I can try to answer. Sure. I know that this is obviously, it's a lot of people are experiencing this, so you're not alone. What happened was, since it's been so long, you know, nobody expected the pandemic to go for, you know, almost 2 years. So yes, so a lot of these vouchers are, you know, they're getting near the end of their sell-by date. And the problem is that the airlines really are, you know, they're not really helping a lot of people. And that has been the source of not just a lot of complaints, but the Department of Transportation actually had to get involved. So one thing I would suggest to you right away is, if you can't get much more satisfaction, you didn't mention which airline it is, file a complaint with the U.S. Department of Transportation, because if this is a flight that touches the United States, it is under U.S. Jurisdiction as well. They can intervene. Secondly, though, I would try to just move it up the chain at the airline that's involved, because I know from several people who, you know, at first just felt that they were not going to get anywhere. They kept on, you know, asking to speak to a supervisor, moving and look to, you know, go up the management chain. And ultimately, you know, the squeaky wheel approach usually does work, because in both the cases I'm aware of, the people did ultimately get satisfaction. So what you need to do, though, is keep be ready to say a couple of possible dates, or at least a time frame, so they know that this isn't going to be something that you're going to come back in a few years. But you can, you know, if you can give them a sense of when you think you might, or your relatives might be using the tickets, that is helpful.
Tim, good luck, and thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Deborah, I want to talk about, a while back you had written about, this is back during the summer, about, you know, good beach travel destinations at that point. If people are thinking, you know, not this holiday weekend, but out into the future, any good travel destinations that people can go to around the world, given current travel restrictions and maybe isn't too expensive this time around, where do you suggest people start looking?
Yeah, well, this isn't so surprising, but I still think Mexico is really, you know, there are so many flights to Mexico. There are so many destinations within Mexico. It's relatively affordable, still is. There's still availability even now, this late into the season. I think there are still hotels, you know, decent prices in Cabo and Cozumel, Cancun. I was just looking myself. So Mexico, Old Reliable, that still stands. And let's see, Dominican Republic, that's another one that was, you know, it's pretty easy to get to through most of this year, and it still is. And the testing requirements aren't too arduous, and there's a lot of great value in the Dominican Republic. And Puerto Rico, you don't have to test. You can fly to Puerto Rico and you don't have to test back in to come to the U.S. That's a great sunny place. And Caribbean's a little trickier. You know, you really have to do your homework, because every one of the islands has a different testing entry requirements. But Jamaica, that's another one. And there's so many nice hotels. So there should still be some spaces, if not over the Christmas holiday, in January, February. Book now for March when it gets really cold and miserable. So there are lots of options.
We're getting some travel recommendations looking at safety when it comes to COVID-19 and air travel in particular. Deborah Dunn and Barbara Peterson are with us, travel writers. You can follow their work in the Wall Street Journal. Call in with your questions or maybe recent travel experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Barbara, you wrote, this is back in late August, about the Delta variant and how we assess travel safety. You were talking earlier about safety on the plane itself. You also wrote in that piece, you know, think about safety in the place you're going and the kinds of experiences you're hoping to have.
Yes, exactly. And also think about whom you're going to be sharing these experiences with. For that piece that you mentioned, I interviewed a number of infectious disease specialists. And one of them says what you really need to focus in on is are you visiting friends and family? Are you visiting anybody who's immunocompromised? Are you actually in good health, or do you have to worry about, you know, being in crowded spaces and things like that? And then, you know, assess each option. I know cruises, of course, really had a tough time in the pandemic because they basically were just completely scrubbed. And it seemed like that was going to be a tall order to get people to go back on cruise ships, you know, given all the factors, you know, that the fact that you're on a ship with a bunch of other people, you're really in close quarters. But it's come roaring back, and in part because the cruise industry, for the most part, is requiring all cruise passengers to be vaccinated and tested frequently during your voyage. I think that, you know, there are a lot of different ways to approach it, but just look at the factors, look at who you're going to be with, and, you know, of course, in a particular country and destination, what's the vaccination rate and what's the infection rate?
Let's go back to our callers now. Nita is with us in Houstonsford. Nita, hi.
Hi. All right. Thank you for taking my call. This is very timely. I was just wondering if the booking sites are at all messed up, if anybody else has had any experience with this. I tried to book a flight out to Austin and a return flight. And what happened was I was able to, you know, normally book the departure, but then, you know, it gave me the charge. And I, you know, I clicked the pay and it kicked me out and it sent me a confirmation for the departure, but it never gave me a chance to book the return flight.
This is a booking site like the kayak sort of thing, Nita?
Yes, okay. Yes.
Deborah, we don't have too much time left. I want to throw that to you. Are booking sites, those third-party sites, working as planned lately?
You know, it's a good question. And, I think, there have been some screw ups, but I always regardless of, you know, now or pre-pandemic, I always like to book direct when at all possible. I just think when things go wrong, it's so much easier to sort them out when you're booking directly from the airline or the hotel company. And, you know, sometimes if you're buying a package, it's kind of hard to get around that great deal. But, I think it's just safer in general to go direct.
All right, Nita, I hope you can get that sorted out. Just a few moments left, Barbara. What are you watching for when it comes to travel numbers over the next couple of months?
Well, I think what we're really looking for is whether or not this trajectory that we're on now is going to continue in a positive direction. You know, their international travel is opening up. In both directions. And, you know, there was a lot of attention paid when we reopened our borders to people from Europe and elsewhere. But also countries around the world have been gradually doing that as well. The problem is that a lot of them, you know, have differing policies, so that can be a little confusing. But I think that whether or not that's actually leading to this big surge in travel internationally is still a question mark. So I think that those are the numbers we want to look for. Want to look for bookings, and people tend to book further ahead for foreign trips. So, you know, right now or in the next few months, people will be booking for spring and summer
Thanks to both of our guests, Barbara Peterson and Deborah Dunn. They both write travel columns for the Wall Street Journal, looked at air travel during the second pandemic holiday. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time.